Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
The energy transition is upon us, but what role will energy companies themselves, together with other businesses and governments, adopt in reaching net zero? Powered by How, an eight-part podcast series from Reuters Plus, in partnership with Aramco, will explore innovations and technologies aiming to move us towards a more sustainable future. Join me, Nisha Pillay, for in-depth analysis of these questions. Aramco powered by How. Listen now.
I'm so excited to tell you a bit about today's sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, Music Masters Collective hosts different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Bill Frisell, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Julian Lage, Mark Ribot, Wayne Krantz, Oteil Burbridge, the Milk Carton Kids, and so many more. At an event like Alternative Guitar Summit Camp happening this August, you can expect in-depth workshops with guitar masters, once-in-a-lifetime performances, the opportunity to play alongside your favorite musicians, and a lot of fun. You'll leave this event packed full of wisdom and with a whole community of musicians to create with. This all-inclusive week in the Catskills Mountains of upstate New York is guaranteed to be magical. Scholarships are available, but spots are extremely limited, so visit www.alternativeguitarsummitcamp.com/inside to learn more.
Hello out there!
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Minahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm your host, Chris Pandolfi from the infamous String Dusters. And this is episode 14 of the podcast. I've got the second part of my conversation with Oteil Burbridge coming up here in just a minute. And if you tuned in to the last episode, you know just how juicy this conversation was. So much interesting stuff. And in the second part here today, Oteil will explain to us the difference between a musical genius and a musical Jedi. And we'll also get some Colonel Bruce Hampton stories, and those are always some of the best, so stick around for that. I'm also going to break down one of the songs from my new record, Transbanjo, that just came out a few weeks ago. We're going to go track by track, instrument by instrument, and give you a unique look inside the music so you can hear all the different parts. And I'll definitely talk about the whole creative process. This is definitely the first kind of concept record that I've ever made, and there's a lot to this one. So I'm excited about this intro. It's going to be kind of like, have you ever seen those classic albums, documentaries? Not that Transbanjo is a classic album by any stretch, but classic albums, Asia, Steely Dan, where Walter Becker and Donald Fagen are sitting at the board soloing up all the guitar solos that didn't make the cut on the record. I love that stuff, and I think it's so interesting to learn a little bit more about the music and how it came together. So we'll get to that here in just a minute. Inside the Musician's Brain is brought to you by Osiris Media, fantastic company that's behind endless quality podcast content. Check them out. We are also brought to you by Americana Vibes. That's the infamous String Dusters record label. And we're gearing up to bring all kinds of cool things your way. Shout out to our sponsors this season, EMG. Love these guys. They make such great gear, including the ACS Soundhole pickup for acoustic guitar. They're mostly known for their electric guitar pickups, which are super high quality, but they make great stuff for acoustic instruments as well. So if you're looking to amplify your instrument, check out EMG. They get bonus points for being made in the USA. Love that. Inside the Musician's Brain is also brought to you by D'Addario, makers of all sorts of quality gear for musicians. And they're always pushing the envelope, coming out with new innovative products. And the XT strings, I've had these on my banjo for quite a while now. Super durable, and the tone is fantastic. So musicians, if you're in need of strings or musical accessories, high praise for our longtime ally, D'Addario. All right, so in this intro, I am excited to talk about creativity and the creative process. I was deep in that process last summer, finishing my new solo record that just came out, Trance Banjo, been out a few weeks now, and actually debuted at number 7 on the Billboard Bluegrass chart, so I was really excited to see that. And yes, I'm well aware that there are people who will not agree that this album is bluegrass, but such is life. I can hear the sirens. I can hear the bluegrass police coming for me right now. But it definitely has elements of bluegrass. The banjo is really the main melodic voice on this album, and that's a departure from my last solo album, Interference, which was definitely more soundscapey, more ambient vibes, synthesizers, beats, virtual instruments, strings, all the different stuff that's here in my studio. And that one was more focused on my chops as a producer. And that role is really about designing the sound and hearing a certain song, a piece of music, and deciding what's the most meaningful way to bring it to life in terms of what instruments should support those melodies and how things should sound and how it should come together. And that's a musical role that I love. That's what happens here in my recording studio. And that's what that last record, Interference, was really all about, was just pushing the boundaries as a producer. And you'll see my solo moniker, Trad Plus, attached to these projects. You can also find them if you search Chris Pandolfi. And quick side note, that term Trad Plus comes from the late, great Doc Watson. I remember seeing him describe his own music as traditional plus, which in his words meant traditional music plus whatever else I'm into. And I just thought that's so badass. That's so cool. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to take all these eclectic sounds that I'm into and use them to recontextualize the banjo. So big props to Doc Watson. So as I was finishing Interference, I was in this awesome, raw kind of creation phase, no real end goal in sight. And I was experimenting with sampling old vinyl records, more specifically sampling these old classical records. And I started using them as part of the sound bed for these new banjo tunes that I was writing. And I was like, man, this is cool. I think I've got something here. So I threw together some demos with some beats and some of these samples and my banjo stuff. And as I was looking ahead to my next solo project, the concept for Trance Banjo was really born in that moment. And the idea was to bring together my skills as a producer, building on Interference, these new symphonic vinyl sounds, and of course, the music that I was writing on banjo. And that was about 4 years ago that this concept first emerged, and that's when I started working on this new album. And it was a much bigger undertaking than I could have ever anticipated, starting with this big experimentation phase and then on to actually writing the tunes and then writing, performing, and recording all the other parts, the sound bed or the band that would support these tunes. And of course, there was experimentation all along the way. And ultimately, the project sat on the shelf just because the Dusters' touring schedule was so busy. And this was my quarantine silver lining, having the time to finally get all the way into this project and finish it. So I'm going to play you one of the tracks here, and then we're going to do a breakdown of the sounds in that track, and then I'll go on to talking a little bit more about the process of how this all came together. So this is track one, Astral Plane. Into the first melody of Astral Plane. And what exactly are we hearing in there in addition to the banjo? And again, that's the role of a producer, taking a piece of music and figuring out what sounds to surround that tune or that song with that will really make it have gravity to the listener. And when I was taking some of these demos and getting ready to turn them into actual songs that would appear on an album, I had to kind of conceive of the band. And again, using a lot of the tools that I'm into here in my studio, a lot of the stuff that was on Interference, analog synths, strings, a lot of virtual instruments. Those are software instruments that are on the computer. Again, the samples, a lot of beats that I programmed, two guests on the record, Stuart Duncan on fiddle and Nick Falk on some live drums. But I built this little sample track that will sort of go through the sounds one by one so you can hear what's going on in that section of music we just listened to. And I left the banjo in at a low volume just to give some context. So we start out with a drum sample. This is actually a chopped up, pre-recorded piece of Nick's playing, and I program beats on all these tracks. That was usually the first thing that went in there. So there's the drum sample. And then the clap track. And that's Nick's live playing coming in. And those three things comprise the beat of the song. And then there's the step sequencer. And then there's that high sustaining drone. And those chimes. I love that sound. There's the bass. And that pizzicato cello sound. Guitar and the analog synth, and all the instruments are pretty much in now as we move to the next section. Stuart Duncan solo over the melody. Man, he is truly the best. An honor to have Stuart on here. So yeah, that's a snapshot of the band sound, and most of those are virtual instruments that I did kind of the sound design and then played here in the studio. Of course, the electric guitar, there's definitely some strings on there, some different guitars, and there's some variation between tunes, of course. Now check this out. This is a section later in Astral Plane where it breaks down and the symphonic stuff is pretty prominent, and I'll mute the band and then bring things back in so you can hear that sound. So everything's still in there. And that's just the sample. And then there's the band back in. That's one of the signature sounds of trance banjo, and I can remember really clearly when that section and a few other sections like it came together, and it was just an awesome moment as a creator where a concept comes together, something really new and different. But more importantly, because I'm not necessarily just in search of something new and unique for the sake of creating something different, it just hit me as something really beautiful and musical and cool and something that I connected with. And that's what we're looking for as artists. And to take that a step further, something that really would support the banjo and recontextualize the banjo in a meaningful way. And that's the concept behind this album. Now, we've looked at a lot of the supporting voices, a lot of the band sounds, but I'm going to give you one last look inside the tune at the melodic voices that are doubling the melodies that I play on banjo or playing harmonies to those melodies. And these melodic voices are the pizzicato cello sound, the electric guitar, and the analog synth. And here's a quick snapshot of one of those melodies. So now you've got a pretty good idea of what all the sounds are on this album, the lead sounds, and then of course the supporting sounds that lay down the groove and outline the chords and just bring all that texture to the music. As far as the process, it wasn't necessarily that linear. Not everything came together in the same way. Some of the music definitely existed on banjo before it got the trance banjo treatment. That would be Astral Plane, this one that we've just looked at, track 2, Silver Droplet, track 6, Cloud Valley, that's also on Adustris Records. So those were the ones that I was really experimenting with 4 years ago. I had those tracks on banjo, and I started working up this treatment. And then as things evolved, I had sort of this template going, and I would start for a few of the tracks actually building the sound bed first, and Asleep at the Wheel of Fortune, the theme song to the podcast, is one of those tracks where I had some of the vibe laid down, and then that would actually inform the leading melodies that I would ultimately write on banjo. So like track 4, Wall Facer, is another one that came together that way. And this creative process went on for a while until I was able to focus in on the 9 tracks that were really working, that would ultimately make it onto the album. And then it was a matter of getting things to the finish line. And that can oftentimes be a really challenging part of the creative process. It's always fun to start a new idea, but to see things through to completion takes a lot of discipline and a lot of vision. And in the case of this album, the next thing for me to do was really finish the tune, finish the banjo melody. But this is an important part of the process. I didn't record the melody at that point. I didn't record the banjo part just yet. I would get everything else done first, the whole sound bed, play and record all those other supporting instruments until the track was totally dialed in, so that I could then go and record the banjo parts as if it was a live recording session. And that was my attempt to bring as much organic, natural feel to the album, because the nature of a project like this that is mostly created by one person, many of these parts are stitched together and pre-planned, but I wanted this leading banjo part to be as natural and as musical sounding as I possibly could, and that was the way that I tried to achieve that. And again, that whole process started about 4 years ago, and I'm just so thrilled to finally have this music out there in the world. I want to say a big shout out to everyone who helped me make it happen. Nick Falk, Stuart Duncan, my two guests on the record, Billy Hume and Drew Becker for helping me get the mix dialed in, and to Glenn Schick, my amazing mastering engineer, and a big shout out to everyone at Americana Vibes, especially Ariel and Hillary, for helping me get the album out there. So now you guys have an inside look at the music. Give Trance Banjo a spin. Hope you dig it. All right, let's jump ahead to the second part of my conversation with the amazing Oteil Burbridge. We actually just announced that I will be special guest with Oteil at some upcoming shows here in Colorado. Can't wait for that, and can't wait to roll the rest of this interview. So here we go.
The dew-covered jungle is the song you sing. Blisters on your hands are your diamond ring.
So all these years later, when I'm after Jess and I were married, she would play guitar, but she would never like strum. She would always finger pick. And I was like, you ever think about playing banjo? Because you always do this. And she, oh man, I'd love a banjo. I was like, well, let's get one, you know? So we got one. Then she moved to Africa to work with Diane Fossey Gorilla Fun. And I'm at home boo-hooing, just so depressed. So I picked up her banjo because it was something that was new, and I wanted to be not good at something again. Plus, I've always loved banjo. And it just was like, let me just give myself something to do. And then, so I remember calling her and going, how did you learn your forward? I didn't even know what they were called yet. I was like, how'd you learn your roles? She was just like, just on YouTube. So I just did beginning banjo roles on YouTube. And I learned my forward roll, my backward roll, and then, you know, alternating thumb and blah, blah, blah. And then I started making different combinations. And then when I started trying to figure out this insane tuning, and that helped me, you know, I started tinkering with the chords the way I do on six-string bass. And then all of a sudden I had all these tunes that came out of exercises. And I started making odd time exercises. And now I'm just down the rabbit hole. I got the Scruggs book. Tony Trischka gave me his password to his teaching website. So I had full access to everything. Now I'm watching Give Me the Banjo documentary that Tony Trischka was the musical consultant for, yeah. Steve Martin. I went and I got Throw Down Your Heart by Bela.
So good.
Now I'm like YouTube and the African guys, but I can't play with them because I've been learning bluegrass. And now I'm frustrated. I'm like, I can't play with my bros on this thing. So then I just forced myself to keep jamming with them. And then I found this thing that unlocked all my like African shit, and that's when all my tunes just exploded. The chordal stuff then got locked into these African patterns, but it's still finger picks.
Man, and there's like, yeah, there's no getting around the Scruggs style on banjo, you know. And the
if you want to do that, like I wanted to play the original, the African style. I wanted to play clawhammer at first,
yeah.
And I was watching TV one day and I had all this big box of knickknacks and it had a bunch of picks in it of Jess's banjo picks, and I took one pick and I just went ding, and it was like
well, I should say as a clarification, if you're using finger picks and you're playing three finger style, yeah, Scruggs is
absolutely
the heart of it all. And some of the best advice I ever got on banjo, I remember I was living in Nashville living with Chris Eldridge from Punch Brothers, and his dad, of course, Ben Eldridge from the Seldom Scene, legendary banjo player, and a great integrator of all these other styles and sounds, especially melodic styles, into a Scruggs-based sort of concept of banjo. And he told me, he said, because I was playing a lot of really progressive stuff that probably was over my head, but that's what I was into. That's how
Bill
your progression
Keith type
with music goes. You learn what you're into, and that's what keeps you fired up. But he said to me, he said, you really need to learn Scruggs style because that's what puts the musical ideas in context. And I always thought that was the best piece of advice I ever got, because banjo, it's like you're playing two instruments at one time. You know, you're rolling, but you're picking out these melodies. And like one way I always sort of explain it to students is like, imagine a horn player. They play a phrase and then they rest and they take a breath. But on banjo, we don't really rest. We keep that roll going.
Never,
And that's the framework. That's the structure. And that's what makes banjo playing sound great. And everyone from the most traditional guys like, you know, Jim Mills and, you know, the really trad guy Scruggs to Bela and that end of the spectrum, the one thing they all have in common is just that solid timing, that rhythm, that right hand. You know, that's what makes it go.
And that's what's kept me from playing it in public. Because, you know, seriously,
well,
because
I know, like, I hear you, man. But how cool is it, though? I love what you said a minute ago. Having something that you suck at is such an asset to all the other things that you're good at, because it's like Zen mind, beginner's mind. The more that we can keep that sort of beginner's attitude in focus, and I'll do that with things that aren't even music. I'll go try to, whatever it is, hit a golf ball and just suck at it, but get it right that one time.
Yep.
And it's like, it's just that pure thing. And if you can take that, mentality, the mentality of a beginner, the whole world is open to you. And also, it doesn't matter how good you are. If you can bring that discipline back to the things that you're really deeply versed in, such an amazing asset.
I heard this preacher say, the most important word is yet. So it could take a negative, you know. So you say, I can't do this. It's like, fine.
Yet.
No, you can't. Yeah. You can't. right now. So right. Then I and picking up banjo brought that back to me. See, this is how these bad things can good can come out of them, no matter how bad it is. Because if Jess hadn't left, I wouldn't have. Because I would not practice bass when I got home. I'd practice drums. I wouldn't even practice. I would play. I play drums. I play piano or keyboard or guitar or something. I didn't want to play the bass. It had gotten wrapped up into this is what it is. It's a career. It's the blah, blah, blah. When I picked up banjo, it reminded me how I felt when I was 14. And every time I had a victory, it was just huge, you know. And then all of a sudden, I made a lot of progress in a quick time, you know, in a short time. But I still had my career that I was doing, and my right hand still is my weakness. Like, left hand, I think, is way ahead of my right. They both need work.
Do you anchor one finger or two fingers on the head with your right hand?
Just the pinky.
Just the pinky.
I have it sitting on my lap right now to check, because I think I tried to make both the pinky and ring, and then when I am not paying attention, then my ring finger comes up.
Yeah.
I think.
So what are
there,
you...
I think there was a little thing I bought one time that you put around these two fingers. You know what I'm talking about? That's some super beginner shit.
So what when you play banjo now, I know it's... I should say, you know, funny story. The first time I think we ever played together were those Roosevelt gigs at the One Up in Denver. And I was so looking forward to it because huge ARU fan and obviously love your music. And we got together there that first day, and it was sort of a thrown together band. We were playing two nights. And you came into the green room, and I was sitting there with my banjo, and you said, "Hey, man, can I get a lesson tomorrow?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, that'll happen." Sure enough, 10 a.m., my phone is blowing up with texts from O'Teal. And we had such a great hang that day, man, just playing banjos at my old apartment.
That was fun, man.
In Denver. I remember it seemed like writing tunes was really the thing that you were mostly into. Is that kind of still what's going on?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, I was doing exercises, and then you kind of make patterns. You know, then I started changing the chords because the pattern here, I'm going to get bored, you know. And then it's like, oh, can I make it in 5? What does it sound like in 7? Can I make a roll in 9? You know, and then all of stuff. So then all of a sudden you kind of have a tune, you know. So they kind of write themselves just out of the learning or exploring process, you know. That's why I say, like, I'm only comfortable playing my songs in public because I can't nearly measure up to other banjo players.
So when is that going to happen, man? When does the world get to see?
It was supposed to be happening. The pandemic took. I had all the rehearsals for it. That's why I bought that Deering, was for that, for those gigs.
Cool.
I was actually taking a guitar tech out for myself for the first time on my solo gigs because I need somebody to. The banjo, you know, banjos are another thing. It's not like just a bass guitar. It's a little more difficult with the floating bridge and all. I was like, man, I ain't touching that. I'll mess it up. I need somebody that knows what's up. And so I had a buddy that was going to do it for me, and then the pandemic took it all away. But it's coming.
I can't wait, man. I look forward to it. One of these days, I want to get up there with you and do some twin banjos in 9.
Oh man, there's many times that I considered calling you to see if you would be the banjo player so that I could stay on the bass, you know.
And how come you didn't?
I just, you know.
No, I'm kidding.
It's not too late because I
was
really
gonna say,
would.
We got time. We got time to make that happen. And
man, I'll send it to you seriously because you know I do have these gigs coming up in February in Colorado.
And, yeah, I know. Josh told me about that. I'm hoping to come down and sit in with you guys.
We were starting out with just 3 of my Afrobilly, too. That's what I call Afrobilly, you know. So I'll be happy to send you those 3 tunes, man. If you learn, I would love to whip those out while we're in Colorado, man. They're really beautiful.
That would be awesome, man. Well, I want to, you know, we got a couple minutes left here. This has been so awesome, O'Teal. I can't tell you how much I appreciate hearing
Sure, I didn't think we were going to go into all this stuff, but, you know, whatever.
It's cool, man. Like I was saying, you know, I checked out some interviews and tons of talk about all the obvious and amazing stuff, you know, Almonds, Dead & Co., and it's been so cool to see you rocking out with you know, titans of the music world who have, you know, such an enduring legacy, and to see you as part of that, you know, and adding what you do is so cool. But I did want to talk a little bit about the ARU before we wrap up, just because
for sure,
man, you guys, I remember Mirrors of Embarrassment and just that sound, man. You guys were so ahead of your time, and it's like jam band is kind of a dirty word, even though I think these days there's a lot more integrity to it than maybe there was at one point in time. But to me, you guys were like fusion and so ahead of your time in that regard, you know, all these different elements of rock and jazz, funk, Latin, bluegrass, country, like it, blues, it just was so cool. And the music was so compelling. For those of you who haven't checked out the ARU, you know, it's you guys have always been sort of this breeding ground for amazing musicians. And I just curious about working with Colonel Bruce, man. Like, what, I mean, the legend's legend. What was that like? What are some things that you took away from that? And just give us a little insight into that experience.
It's so hard to like condense. In fact, Dave Schools, who just did our podcast, I think his comes out today, actually. We were talking and we were like, yeah, we got to have a semi-marathon podcast just about the Colonel, because there's so, like, the Colonel always had the best musicians, like going back to 69, you know, like that's one of the first mysteries about him. It was like, well, technically from like a Berklee School of Music standpoint, he can't play, but he always had the best players.
Like, and why was that?
Because they all knew the same thing that I found out, and that is that he is an extraterrestrial and a great musician, but that great music doesn't necessarily have to come from a good musician, right? Like, someone was asking us, I think, last night, who are geniuses? Who do you consider geniuses of music? I said, well, I can name those, but, you know, the question for me is a genius, a musical genius, the highest thing rung for me? And it's not. To me, like a musical Jedi, someone who can wield the force, is what I need more out of music. So,
so what does that mean? Break that down for us.
Like, Keith Jarrett is a musical genius, but Howlin' Wolf is a musical Jedi. Okay. To see Howlin' Wolf live would damn near overwhelm you. And I know, because I've spoken to people who did see it live, and they said to see that much energy, you can't even say be transmitted. It's just wielded. He couldn't even help it. That's why I'm not impressed by anybody. I'm impressed by people that, yes, if you're a good steward of your gift and you take care of it and you work hard and you go far, but still I feel God's just using you to show off. Like, you can't explain why you can do it better and someone else can't. Hmm. Like, it comes way easier to me than it does to other people. It does. That's just a fact. You know, like, if I were to practice like I should practice, I'd be so much better than I am now, you know?
So what I'm hearing is it's not a function of technique. It's not a function even necessarily of
There are geniuses that are also Jedis.
Okay.
Right?
But that comes more as a function of intention, channeling that thing.
Now we're into the mystical thing, because now it's like, you know, all men are not created equal in all things. You know, and some people can just do, like, you know, when I saw Derek Trucks when he was like 13, and you're just like, that's impossible. Okay, so if you don't believe in miracles, go see that dude. Like, get the hell out of here. Like, you know, so, and Colonel Bruce could do that too. Colonel Bruce was like, I don't even need an instrument. And I was like, okay. And he would take off his shoe and he'd stand there and he'd just hold his shoe. And he, what he did is he created anticipation. He created, now people are waiting to see what happens. And then he would hold it. He would just hold there and just let the anticipation build and build. And now people are thinking, they're creating scenarios in their head about what's going on. And then he would just drop it and the gig would be up. Everybody like, ah! And he'd look at me like, I could do this shit all day long. I was just like, wow. He was like, music is life and life is drama, you know. The drama of music is your life. It's not, he said, what you're doing is running your hands over a piece of wood. I want to hear your life, you know? And then I started looking at the players that he was really into and what he was hearing. And I was like, oh, I get it now. And he helped me understand folk music. Like, I didn't understand Delta blues. I didn't understand bluegrass. I didn't understand. But then when I got to know the people, when I got to know Matt Mundy, when I played some bluegrass festivals, and I hear the music, and I go, oh, I hear the coal mine. I hear, you know, their story.
Okay.
Their
life. That's what you mean. You hear what's underneath the music. You hear the person.
The folk musician is like the truest, most honest musician. But all the most technically whatever music that's great still has that folk element in it, whether it's Stravinsky or whether it's Art Tatum or Charlie Parker or Coltrane or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Miles. It has that folk, that human, you hear it. If you listen to bebop from afar, you hear New York. You hear the horns and the traffic. You hear the You know, you just hear it. It's right there. It's right there, man. You know,
and a lot of that is a function of focusing on what you are and what nobody else is, and being that original
moment. Yeah, even just the moment.
Yeah.
Like my old guitar player, Mark Kimbrell, he's the greatest, man, because he couldn't help it. And other musicians would probably say he's inconsistent because he didn't play the same every night. But whatever was going on in his day was what is exactly what would come out of his guitar. Yeah. And I thought that was the truly consistent thing because he was playing the truth of his moment every time. And there was no question about it, whether he was happy, pissed off, whatever it was, you know, anything, playful, you know, depressed, whatever. Like, that's what came out. And I thought that, to me, is the highest. That form of genius and Jedi, that's what I've won out of it. That's what's the highest.
Yeah.
Not who's the baddest.
When you start getting past all the technique and all the transcription, you start to practice and work on another thing that, you know, I feel like I've barely scratched the surface of, but that's one I consider one of the greatest gifts, again, of a career in music, the adversity, the challenge of getting on stage or at the proving ground, this forum for working on that next intangible thing, which is just do your own shit, be real, be present, be in the moment, let your ego, you know, slide away for a second and see what's there.
That's what Bruce called the mirror of embarrassment. He said you have to fully embrace the mirror of embarrassment. You're getting up there. I want you to get up there buck naked with a spotlight on you and microscopes blowing up in high def, even though we didn't have high def in 88. You know, not like, you know. But he was just saying all your moles, all your shit that you want. He's like, that's what I want.
A stained soul cringes at the
small details.
In the mirrors of embarrassment.
At the small details.
Yeah.
I want all that. Yeah.
What about, man, Matt Mundy? Holy crap. Dude, I'll never forget, you know, of course, I came to the banjo through Bela. Tales from the Acoustic Planet, Volume 1. Still my favorite all-time Bela record, and track one, Up and Running. Before I was deep enough, you know, I was in high school, and I didn't know who all the players were, and you couldn't just go on Google, whatever. But
yeah,
for like years, I'd play. I didn't have the liner notes, and that mandolin on track one. He's on a few tracks on that record, and then finally connecting the dots to the ARU stuff, and it was like
yeah.
that amazing intersection of all the things, like technique, but originality, yes. and then presence. Like you just heard.
Man.
Yeah. Him, he was on the rails of the moment, and it was so exciting to listen to every time.
It just was, he was a continual wonder to me. And while we were figuring out all this harmonic stuff, you know, stuff we were, I was just exploring with just having got the six string bass. You know, me, him, and Jimmy were all there right at the same time, like trying to figure out how can we do this and where we don't lose Bruce. And that, honestly, on a side note, was a great proving ground because Bruce needs that 1-4-5. And so if we extrapolated things way, way out, if he could still hear the 1-4-5 in it and not get lost, we were like, success. Because that means we're also not losing
sure.
the average person.
The listener.
But yeah, but Matt Mundy was like, man, just... And even I talked to John Cowan, and he was like, man... He's the cat after Sam Bush. His right hand is, and I don't know if I've said this publicly or you know, where anybody could quote me, but and anybody could get mad at me, or and I might be wrong, but I still, when I listen to mandolin players, I don't hear that right hand like Matt, man. Matt just has this thing. And an intangible thing. You can't teach it. You know, he's a Jedi, man.
Yeah, incredibly. incredibly forceful, incredibly, you know, just there's meaning in that music. There's so much intention. And he was kind of MIA for a while, but I looked on YouTube and you can find videos of him playing in like in this coffee house in Georgia, you know, last year.
When I moved back to Atlanta, we haven't been there in about 4 years, but we lived there for 7 years.
Yeah.
And I hooked back up with him because I was in Lawrenceville, so coming wasn't that far away.
Yeah.
And I would go drive up there. In fact, this metronome I got at his store, you know, the little
music
store
the
they have up in
Cal.
Old school metronome. I still use it all the time. And, yeah, so he's playing again, and that's really cool. And I used to go hang up there with him, and he just latched on. I was amazed at how easily he picked up African and Afro-Cuban rhythms because he's such a great drummer on mandolin. So he was already doing it. And if you listen to Scruggs, all these upbeats and stuff, you know, like I think Robert Palmer did this like – ethnomusicological study. Is that the right word? Anyway, the thesis of it was that only in Africa do you find music where the two is stressed, where the two is like the one. That's the swing. And to me, that's like blue, except for bluegrass. He said it's only black musics that do. There's no white musics that do that. And I said, I think that... The bluegrass is the one exception. Because when I listen to Scruggs, I hear all this Afro-Cuban and African stuff. Because it's all the syncopated stuff. It's all the upbeats. Yes, it's the one. The bass player's playing the one. But the mandolin player's chopping the two. So that's like the hi-hat and swing.
Yep.
And that's where the swing comes from. That swing. So I think bluegrass is the one exception. But it makes sense because... It was the banjo comes from Africa, so of course.
Well, and Scruggs is so cool too because like when people think syncopation, you know, they think like swung eighth notes, but he played so even and played all these notes, but he could put that accent wherever he wanted, and that was where the money is at.
Dude, that's where the money, and that's what just pulled me right in. And that I think that's why me and Matt Mundy were just the rhythm. You know, and then we were on both on this harmonic exploration that was new to both of us. I had just got the six string for the first time in 91. I had been playing with the ARU already for 3 years at that point, you know? And so it was brand new, and we went on that exploration together. So all the stuff that, you know, I was figuring it out and showing him, he would just like have it like that. He'd go to the, he'd see it, and then on the gig that night, it was like, he was fluent.
Musical Jedi. I was just
like, this guy's insane.
Yeah.
Like, well, I've never seen anything
like
it.
Man, you guys, ARU, I'll say it again, you guys have provided so much inspiration. And even though,
Thank you.
And I remember I was hearing you talk about it on Frasco's podcast, and it wasn't about the commercial success. It wasn't about making money. It was just about...
We were starving.
Yeah, but you guys were ripping, and you guys were really laying that groundwork for, you know, if you look at the music scene today, bands like ours, Leftover Salmon is a great example, fusion bands. The playing has really come a long way now that the kind of jam circuit, for lack of a better word, was kind of inundated with some kind of half-cooked bands for a minute. But there's a lot of great, great, great musicians on that scene who have all these things we're talking about. And yeah. ARU, man, you guys really, really started a trend, the OG fusion band, man.
Well, I think we really needed to learn from each other because, you know, I always felt like my wife is a good gauge. People that are not musicians, although I can't say that about her because she's a good piano player, but a lot of people that are not musicians are a good gauge for if we're doing it right. Because for me, it is like coming from African music, everything you're doing, it's a community thing. You're doing it for the dancers. Like, you know what? You're doing it to communicate what the beats meet, whatever that's, whatever it pertains to, a celebration or whatever. You know, so there's always that people element for it. It's not just to be the crazed genius that sat in a room and now I am, you know, like, it's not that, you know, like bluegrass is not that, you know. So I feel like the fusion guys and the more technical guys need to learn more from the folk guys that maybe don't have as much chops, but that connect with people more. Now, if we can take that, if we could get some of that and put it all together, then you have like people out there that do both, like a Louis Armstrong or a Miles Davis, sure, or a Stevie Wonder or a...
Yeah. Bluegrass is, man, incredibly deceptive that way. You know, at first glance, the music can seem simple and just a few chords, but man, when you go deep, when you hear Ralph Stanley's singing, or when you hear the crowd reaction when Scruggs first played the Opry with Monroe, I mean, the people went ballistic.
Absolutely.
And the music has this incredible energy, and it has the chops, and it has all the elements that make us go, but then it also has this cultural thing and this
I mean, consider this, dude. The first bluegrass musicians that I saw play live were Matt and Mark Mundy, Scott Vestal, and Jeff Autry. I was like, holy shit.
Vestal is my boy.
These guys are playing. I don't care what style of music you're into.
Yeah.
These dudes are playing. These are serious players. But that whole, the deep tie to the tradition and the folk, you know, the whole thing, like you get that. I was just like, wow, this is, I was eternally fascinated, but still am.
Scott's banjo playing is,
oh my God.
He's kind of top five all time for me. And it's crazy because, you know, I was hearing him with the Sam Bush band, and I was hearing him on his solo projects. And then someone was like, have you ever heard Scott Vestal play with Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver? And you can hear him play Scruggs to the letter.
Oh, and dude, he
hearing that,
that. Yeah.
You know, that was one of the things that really cemented that notion that Scruggs is the framework, you know. And if you can
absolutely,
you can learn that stepping stone and let everything else flow from there, you're really going to have, you know, what I think is a complete sound on banjo.
Yeah. And one day I'll get there.
One day I hope to have something like that. But, man, Oteil, what a pleasure having you on today, brother.
Thank you
enough, seriously. And
same here. I always love, I love hanging with you, man.
Likewise.
I wish that I had more time to do it. I want to play some of those. You told me about all those banjos you got. I was like, oh, I'm not worthy, but I'd love to play every friggin' one of them. You know?
Well, let's try to connect when you're out here in Colorado, and you know, when you're ready for some five string and some of your tunes. And
yeah, look, I'm serious, man. Like, I will call you back on FaceTime or Zoom anytime. To where I'll send you those tunes as soon as we get off of this, and if you're game, you know, I'll go over them with you. I have some acoustic banjos in my storage space too, so I would love for you, man. Oh, because then I could play bass, because the bass lines are so African, man. Yeah. And it needs that touch on it, you know.
Well, send them over, yeah. and we'll make it happen. And just thanks, man, for the inspiration over the years, all the great music, and you know, your friendship as well. It really means a lot, and it's been Same such here. A pleasure talking to you today.
And you know, one thing I don't know if I want to say, because I was gonna do a post about it during the whole George Floyd thing. Remember when everybody posted this, those black? There was nothing on Instagram. The whole thing was just black. Mm-hmm. And I know there were some really hardcore, you know, black militant people that were like, yeah, that's bullshit. That was the industry wanted you to do that. And I get it. That's true. But the thing that struck me about it was, you know, in my feed, there are lots of banjo players and bluegrass musicians and people that don't play banjo. Or you don't think of as a banjo player like Billy Strings or something, even though I'm pretty sure he does play banjo. But all those bluegrass musicians and banjo players had those black screens come up, and I thought, I need to screenshot each one of these and do a post, because people are so stereotypical of bluegrass musicians, white Southerners in general, and it really pisses me off, because as someone who has been stereotyped, you know that it's not true. Like, not everybody's that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, people would have to have my feed to realize, you know, like, I would love to hand my feed to, like, not that I would have to convince my sister, but, you know, the average black person that would never think this and go, look, you know, look at one bluegrass musician after another going, fuck this shit. We're not down with this racist bullshit.
Yeah. You know? And the music has evolved not just in the aesthetic, but also geographically. And
yeah,
it's everywhere now.
But it's that way in the South, too. I mean, Ralph Stanley came out and endorsed Obama the first time.
That's right.
You know, and it goes all the way back. I mean, look at High Lonesome and Bill Monroe talking about that old black guy that taught him how to play, I guess, the blues stuff, and he took that and put it together with his grandma's Celtic tunes and created bluegrass. There's always been this thing, and me and Matt Mundy represented that generation's version of what has happened all the way since we got here.
Oh, man, the roots,
you know,
I mean, are undeniable. And, you know, look at the banjo, look where it came from, you know. And
but that's what I'm saying. Everybody, I won't say everybody, but a lot of people think, white and black, that all those people on the white side were just all racist. And I'm like, no, let's not do the same stereotyping. So I thank you for that. You know, I don't have to thank you for not being a racist, but, you know, thank you for, man, when I do that post to help me prove my point.
For sure, man. No, I know what you mean, and I observe the same thing in my feed, and I've engaged people in some tough conversations, and, you know, it's just another clear indication that people are really a product of where they come from, and to open your mind, you know, you need some exposure, and hopefully we're getting some of that in this time, because bluegrass does have a lot more diversity of thought, diversity of people who play the music. And if we are to deny our roots, it's like bluegrass wouldn't exist if it weren't for myriad, you know,
yes,
influences from all over the cultural spectrum. So it's I appreciate
how about
you
Newgrass
that,
getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. I thought that was so great, man.
Yeah.
You know, those guys were out on a limb, man, like playing reggae and shit. You know, people were like,
oh, that was my jam.
That was this thing. It was like, that ain't like Earl, you know.
Yeah. No, that
which means it's wrong.
That's always that's how all types of evolution doesn't come without growing pains in music and society. Yeah. And, you know, those guys blazed a trail, and I think we're starting to see that trail was bigger than just the music, you know, and
yes,
thankfully so, because the music does have such a broad appeal, and I feel like bluegrass is cool again, man, and it's starting to get out there and starting to really get its due, and It's appreciated by a lot of people who don't know about this history, and just give it to a fresh set of ears, and that music is pretty undeniable.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Well, thanks again, brother, for doing this. Really appreciate it, man. Love hanging with you any chance we get. And hit me up with those banjo tunes, and I'll try and catch you when you make it out this way.
Absolutely. Love you, brother.
All right. Likewise. Thanks so much, Oteil. Talk to you soon, man.
Bye.
That's a wrap on another episode of Inside the Musician's Brain. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Big thanks to my amazing guest, Oteil Burbridge. Big shout out to Osiris Media and Americana Vibes for helping me make the podcast happen. And to our excellent sponsors, EMG Pickups and D'Addario. I'm Chris Pandolfi, signing off for now, but I'll see you back here in 2 weeks for another episode of Inside the Musician's Brain.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil Story Made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, you. Did you have any plans this year? Ha! How's that going? Did you get 2020'd? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020'd, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020'd.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.